The Confederate flag is controversial as a weirdly enduring symbol of the Civil War South. Well, an artist with a show in Kansas City has an idea for how to flip the script. There was actually another flag that Confederate forces once waved. It's the one they waved in Virginia back in 1865 to announce their surrender. It's called the truce flag, and it's basically a woven dish rag. What if that was the enduring symbol of the Civil War South? The artist is Sonia Clark. She's a professor of art at Amherst College in Massachusetts, and her show, which has generated national buzz, is called The Flag We Should Know. It's at the H&R Block Art Space in Midtown. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Sonia Clark, good morning.
Hi, it's so nice to be here with you, Gina.
It's nice to have you. Tell me, first of all, tell me more about the truce flag. What's the story there?
Yeah, so this is this amazing thing. I just happened to be doing a residency at the Smithsonian, and which is this lovely, lovely residency where they invite artists to come to our nation's biggest museums and poke around, find something that might be of interest. And I happened to be in the American History Museum, where the Star-Spangled Banner is housed. I went upstairs and I saw Lincoln's top hat. We're all familiar with that. And then right next to that was this really humble, commonplace dish rag. And I said, well, what is that? And it was the Confederate truce flag, used at Appomattox to signal the surrender of the Confederate troops and the end of the Civil War. Why didn't I know this flag?
Yeah, it is interesting that the flag that represented the ongoing fight while it was happening is the one that we remember, whereas the one that signals the whole future of America from that point on is not the one that endures.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, given the unfortunate legacy of white supremacy, white privilege, and white terrorism in this nation, that what we commonly call the Confederate flag or the Confederate battle flag or the rebel flag is the propaganda that has been used in this nation in sort of sometimes really insidious, benign ways. Like I think about the Dukes of Hazzard. I grew up in the 70s watching the Dukes of Hazzard, and yeah, there are these guys with a big Confederate flag on their car called the General Lee. And that was fun to watch after school.
Yeah, super weird.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it about the, like, the physical appearance of this, what appeared to be a dish rag, what was actually the truce flag? Mm-hmm. You saw the real thing. What was it about it as an object that interested you?
So actually, it's subtlety. So knowing that this subtle, commonplace dish rag, it really is a dish rag.
It does not just appear to be one.
No, it doesn't appear to be one. So just to backtrack for a second, the Confederate troops were looking for a white cloth, a pure white cloth.
Because white flag of surrender.
That's right. That's right. And it was hard to come by pure white cloths at the time. So there isn't a business of making white surrender flags. So they were looking for white cloths, and they actually couldn't find one. What they found was a dishcloth that was predominantly white. And this dishcloth actually looks like and was woven in a similar way to dishcloths that people have in their homes right now. This one happens to be linen, not cotton. And it has three minimal red stripes, thin red stripes on either end, which gives it a design element. So to me, there was something about knowing that this very humble cloth that moved from domestic space to the battlefield was sort of hidden in plain sight. And I'm a textile artist, so the power of this textile to be a monument really appealed to me. It seemed like it was calling to me to do something with it and about it.
Can we talk a little more first, before we talk about what you did with it, about the Confederate flag itself and the way it kind of sticks around in our culture? We've discussed it a little bit with the Dukes of Hazzard, but can you give some examples of other ways in which the Confederate flag sticks around, ways that some people might not even notice in their day-to-day lives?
Well, actually, if I can answer both questions, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to the show, because one of the things that I'm so interested in is just how much the Confederate battle flag has become just part of our everyday culture. So the Dukes of Hazzard, of course, is one example. I made a piece called Propaganda that is in the show, and it's a list of over 240 items of regularly available commercial items, products that you can get online that are emblazoned with the Confederate flag. And they range, Gina, disturbingly, from baby onesies to wedding rings to yoga mats. This is a symbol of hate, slavery, white supremacy, white terrorism, and I just cannot imagine.
The wedding ring especially.
Oh, the yoga mat is a one. Yeah, and the baby onesie.
All I mean, of them, they're like, all weird. I guess I can't
all
pick a weirdest.
They're so disturbing, right? But can you imagine if there were the same kind of items in an SS flag? Like, no. So there's been this benign sort of slippage and this propaganda of using that flag as a symbol for perhaps something else. Like, it's okay. It's a sign of rebellion. I mean, these were enemies of the state, right? Why would we ever have anything emblazoned with a symbol of enemies of the state?
What does it stir up for you personally when you see these odd references to this flag in your everyday life in 21st century America?
Right. So can I share with you one other really odd reference that is in the show as well? So should people from your listening audience be able to make it to the show, they will notice that those very thin red stripes that are in the original flag, the original truce flag, become point of focus wall in the space. There are a couple of red walls in the space. And we use that because, of course, the truce flag is white. The space is sort of neutral. We needed a color that popped. Why not pick this color? So one of the people from the Fabric Workshop and Museum, which is the place where the show originated, said, let me take some of those red threads that we have dyed and go to Benjamin Moore and color match. So we have a red wall to pop. And the color match at Benjamin Moore, on the paint ship, between raspberry truffle and cherry wine, which sound like delightful things,
truly,
is color 2080, and it's called Confederate Red. And it used to be referred to on Benjamin Moore's website as a classic and enduring color.
And they have since changed the color.
Yes, and this but only in 2014.
No, I know. But yeah. the weirdness in that is also what they changed it to.
Exactly. So they changed the color to Patriot Red. So to take this notion of enemies of the state, people who were white terrorists, people who now use this symbol for white terrorism and for white supremacy and white nationalism, and then to rebrand it as patriotism, is so disturbing, but actually not surprising given who is currently in office.
So I went to the exhibit yesterday, and you riff on this idea of trading out the Confederate flag for the truce flag in a lot of different ways. And I want to start with the giant truce flag that fills a whole room. For me, seeing what looks like a dish towel created on that scale, displayed with just hanging something flag-sized, mm-hmm. is a form of reverence, which you don't necessarily realize until you're looking at a dish towel displayed that way. And, you know, it made this really visceral point that I could really feel in my bones that, you know, why should it feel out of place to see a dish rag held up this way, but weirdly normal to see a flag that represents human bondage get that kind of honor?
Exactly. Thank you for understanding my work, Gina.
It was very visceral to be like, that's weird, but that shouldn't be as weird as this other thing that's normal.
Exactly. And how did that thing become normalized? And that's the thing about propaganda, is that it's an insidious thing. It can just sort of sneak up on you. So I have this story about when I was a kid growing up in Washington, D.C. We went to King's Dominion, which was a theme park, and we were all excited to get on the roller coaster at the time. This is in the late 70s, early 80s. I have fond memories of this because I got my first kiss from a boy that I had a crush on.
That'll make it stick.
Yeah, so we all got on this great roller coaster, and we're encouraged to, like, scream. And that roller coaster was called the Rebel Yell, named for the battle cry of Confederate soldiers. Also, masking is fun. Really no different than Confederate red being tucked on this paint chip card between cherry wine and raspberry truffle.
You know what's especially awful about that, actually, is that then anyone who screams on that roller coaster is kind of complicit, too.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, I mean, that's the power of propaganda. So I appreciate that you understand that this humble cloth, when made in a monumental scale, can sort of hopefully make us think about the reverence and the work of truce and surrender and what actually was surrendered, you know, or not at the time of the Civil War. The display of that piece was actually in relationship to the Star Spangled Banner, which in the American History Museum is in a very reverent space. So the scale of that piece, 10 times the size, just to let your listening audience know, the piece is 15 by 30 feet. So it's a really large woven cloth.
Yeah, it is. I counted how many steps it took me to walk across, and it was 15.
Yeah.
There is a classroom exercise that you invite visitors to participate in where they can make their own truce flags while sitting at those little classroom desks with the chairs attached that I think we all probably remember. Explain that exercise.
Right. So what we did in that situation is that we laser etched those old school wooden desks with the texture of the truce flag, because it's a very specific waffle weave texture. And if you don't know what a waffle weave is, you probably have been in like Target and held a dish rag that has the same weave structure. It's made to be absorbent. So it's got a very specific kind of texture, and people can take a piece of black Tyvek and put it on over that cloth and then do a rubbing of the texture. And then they can walk away with this rubbing, black Tyvek, white wax of a white truce flag. So they understand the cloth. And the idea is like, why don't we know this cloth? How do we come to know things? And that piece is called Lesson Plans. Like, this is one of those lesson plans that is missing in our history lessons, and trying to sort of balance out that historical imbalance.
Yeah, having people actually go through the exercise too feels like in some ways surrendering to a re-education.
Yes. Yeah, that's a nice reading. Thank you, Gina, for that.
You also have a communal weaving of truce flags. People can sit down at looms and help make them. Churning out more and more of these things seems like an important part of the point about just how prolific this thing would have to be to compete with the Confederate flag.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, the woven ones are a little different. Like, in that sense, I want people to have the experience. For some people, it's their first weaving experience. And so their first weaving experience is helping weave this truce flag and really contemplating the complexity of the weave structure and the complexity of the Civil War and how we got there and how we got where we are now in the history of this nation. And so what ends up happening with those ones is that people are weaving on a very, very long warp. So they, when they come off the looms, they're almost like scrolls of history. They're much longer than the original truce flag, which is only 18 inches by about 36 inches. Just dish rag size, just yeah. Dishcloth size. You all know how big that is. You have one in your kitchen right now. But these end up being much, much longer as a way of sort of tallying or marking or tracing people's learning experience around what the truce flag is and their experience of it. Yeah.
I also want to talk to you about the cleaning dress hanging up next to a bucket with a Confederate dish rag in it. It's a reference to a performance you did where the truce flag is flown and the Confederate flag is used to clean floors. This sort of swapping. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah. So thinking about this propaganda wall, this, you know, 240 items that are on the wall as one of the pieces, I said, well, okay, of all the things that are on that you can buy with a Confederate flag. One of them is a dish towel. So let's do a reversal. Let's take a dish towel emblazoned with a Confederate flag and use it for the purposes of cleaning. And so what I did in Philadelphia was we gathered dust from Independence Hall and Declaration House, the two places that are where our Declaration of Independence were written and housed, and wrote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. You can see we already have a problem. Like, we just have the men. And when we're talking about women, like women's suffrage, which, you know, we have the anniversary of that this year, that was only white women. Black people didn't get the access to vote till much later. So, you know, we have problems in the foundation of this nation. So I am dressed in a dress that is a reproduction of the dress that Ella Watson wore in Gordon Parks's famous American Gothic. If you don't know it, look it up, and it probably will be familiar to you.
Yeah, and Gordon Parks is actually from here.
Oh, yes, of course. That's a nice connection. That's, of course.
He's a local celebrity.
Yeah.
And so, bigger than that celebrity, too.
Yes. So Gordon Parks photographed Ella Watson, who was a domestic laborer, like many of the people in my family who have allowed me to be where I am as a college professor because of the work they have done and all of those who continue to do that kind of work. So I centered her, right? So I'm dressed as her, and I'm cleaning this dirty text, cleaning this dirty floor to reveal the dirty text that still isn't as clean as we would like it to be. And what I'm using to clean that is this dishcloth that has been emblazoned with a Confederate flag. It's actually the only place in the whole exhibition where a Confederate flag appears. Everything else is a truce flag.
What did it feel like to actually do this performance, to be in that dress, to use that dishcloth, and to use it in this really revered space that represents the founding of our nation?
Mm-hmm. But the founding of our nation is actually tricky. The roots of this nation are pretty complicated. I mean, this is a nation that for all of its verbiage about freedom, there's the paradox and the hypocrisy about also subjugation and mass genocide. That's the foundation of the nation. So what I'm attempting to do in that piece is to honor people who are doing that work to clean up the heartbreaking part of our nation, people like Ella Watson. And when I did that performance, it actually, I've only performed it once, I got quite emotional. I'm getting a little emotional just talking about it now, because I didn't know what power it would feel like to be in this space. Just for people to understand, people, it was in a pretty small gallery space. People were, the audience was on the periphery, and I ignored them. I just went about my work. If people were in my way, I ignored them. They moved, they had to move out of my way. And they had to pay attention to the work that I was doing as Ella Watson.
Because you weren't waiting till everything was closed down and doing it invisibly.
That's right. Exactly. And I think about all the invisible labor that happens in this nation, like the food we eat because of migrant laborers, the prison industrial complex that is now just essentially replaced plantations. There's all this way in which labor gets put aside, were out of view as we continue to subjugate and oppress people who are doing much of the work that sustains the economics of this nation.
What has it been like to tour the country with this exhibition and this idea, and especially in the current political climate? The Confederate flag has been controversial since it was created, I am guessing, but
of course, because it was a flag of rebellion.
Right.
So of course.
But in recent years, the controversy has heightened once again, become like part of the mainstream public conversation again. Mm-hmm. It must be an interesting time to go from place to place and see how different communities respond to your work.
Yes. So this project, along with other ones where I really very directly interrogate the Confederate flag, there is most of the people who are coming to my exhibitions are in a political space in terms of their political mindedness. They understand what the project is about. But I've also had people who have had this sort of these confessional moments where they're saying, you know, when I grew up, this was a sign of masculinity. In fact, a student just said this to me last night. A student at KCAI said he's from the South, and like the rebel flag was like, you're tough and you're a rebel. And actually, even that notion is sort of anti-American, to think about surrendering, even if you're fighting for white supremacy and white terrorism. Like, so we have to think about what we need to surrender to move forward and actually make this nation a nation that promises freedom for all, as opposed to the privilege of some.
What does surrender mean to you in that context? You say we need to surrender some things, like, and you give the example of attaching masculinity to the Confederate flag. What else do we need to surrender?
Well, I think that one of the things that happens is that, I mean, I think about this quite often. Like, I walk with a fair number of privileges, right? I'm a college professor. I'm a middle-aged woman. Or a middle-aged person. I have age on my side and hopefully a little bit of wisdom, or if not experience, right?
Gravitas.
Yes, I'm middle class, you know, those kinds of things. But I'm also a Black woman, right? In the United States of America, a nation that wasn't formed for me, not for women, not for Black people. So I walk with both privilege and potential oppression. And I consider it my responsibility to use my privileges to help free others. So one of the things is to figure out where your privilege lies and figure out what you can surrender from your privilege to make space to correct that imbalance and that paradox of a nation that is built for freedom. But freedom for whom?
Kansas City is right on the border historically.
Yeah, I know, right?
I'm wondering how this particular location affects you as an artist who is constantly grappling with this specific Civil War history and its legacy, to be in this spot where you're right on the line between what used to be free state versus slave state, where some of the bloodiest fights went down, and where people here, I mean, it's kind of a shocking thing again and again, I've encountered it again and again, and I get re-shocked by it again and again, how alive the Civil War is for a lot of people here.
So, you know, in one sense, I'm staging a reenactment, you know, in the case of that performance, Reversals. And in another sense, I'm also using a historical object and turning it into a monument. I mean, the project is called Monumental Cloth, the flag we should know, because I'm actually sort of pushing back at this notion that the nation had all these conversations about hunks of metal and pieces of stone, monuments to Confederate generals and soldiers, that the Confederate battle flag is a more sustained monument. You could take them all down and most of us could still draw one. And so that is a more dangerous kind of monument, right? So I love these border places. I think that's where the work actually, it is like a battlefield. It's right on the edges of the border. Like, what are you going to do in this situation? We're at war right now. We're in a nation that is caging children, and Black and brown people and killing people. And we see them right in social media, killing people, innocent people, or people who are committing minor crimes. Meanwhile, treating people like Dylann Roof, who was a mass murderer, like, and saying, would you like some McDonald's before we take you in? So we see this all the time. So we are actually in my opinion, in a conceptual place, it is really no different than the battle line, but it might be, it might just feel a little different because there's not blood being shed. And I have lots to say about this.
There's not an actual line.
Yeah. Blood is being shed, but not on a battlefield in the way that we think of war. Yeah.
Artist Sonia Clark, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Gina. I really appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Sonia's exhibit, The Flag We Should Know, is on view now at the H&R Block Art Space. I'm Gina Kaufman. In just a minute, we'll be turning our attention to Frankenstein, but not according to Hollywood. That's next. That scene from the Hollywood version of Frankenstein is so famous that I almost don't even need to tell you that it's Frankenstein. A lot of us hear that thunder and lightning in our heads as soon as anyone says the name Frankenstein, but a playwright cautions us against letting this movie stand in for the novel by Mary Shelley. It's a novel about a scientist who craves knowledge. He believes in the power of the human mind, and he uses that mind to create something, a monster that he can't control. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Kyle Hatley to talk about the Frankenstein he's created, a play Kansas City audiences can see starting tonight at The Rep. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You hate that movie, don't you?
Well, I have a love relationship with it.
Love relationship. That's a nice way
yeah.
So two positives equal a negative.
I guess so. When you compare it though to Mary, when you compare any version to what Mary actually wrote, I feel like it doesn't quite hold what she was able to capture, or what she like. There were so many things more terrifying about what she wrote and more heartbreaking about what she wrote than what I've seen on film. And I think that's what I mean. But at the same time, what we see in film, it still tries to sort of carry some of her ideas.
So you are the playwright. You're also an actor / storyteller. You're the person on stage.
That's right.
Explain this.
Yeah. So a few years ago, in 2015, I had done this show at The Rep called An Iliad. And it was sort of a one person on stage with someone who we identified as a muse, who was a musician that was kind of playing and scoring some of the stories he was telling from this version of the Iliad. And I enjoyed doing that production so much, it sort of inspired an idea to find a way to do something like that again, or at least it educated me on how to take a big story and do it in a small way, a small but mighty way. And I think that's what led me to, well, actually my wife, when we moved to LA, I told my wife that, you know, I really wanted to read some classics. And for Christmas that year, she bought me Frankenstein. I read it before New Year's and fell madly in love with it. And then I read it again and started making these notes. And then by July of 2018, I had 45 pages of a one-man show that also had a musician. So essentially, what it became is the story of this musician and this storyteller who, back in the day, used to travel the world, sort of, and you know, from city to city, from country to country, kind of telling these old classic stories. And one of them happened to be Frankenstein. And now we sort of meet up with them a few years after they haven't done it for a while, and you kind of learn some things about them. And part of it is that we tell all of Mary's story. As she wrote it in 90 minutes, and it's so you're going to get all of the scary stuff, all of the moving stuff, but not word for word,
yeah,
correct?
That would take longer than 90
correct.
Minutes.
Like you'll hear famous lines and stuff from it. But for instance, like you know, like what the difference between what Hollywood did and what Mary did is, you know, right off the bat, the storyteller talks to us and says there was no Igor. Victor never said it's alive, and then he confesses a few other things after that, but what we've done with this production that makes it unique, and what we hope really honors what Mary went through when she was writing it, because what she went through was horrifying from the age of 17 to 25 years old before she finished the production, or the version that we now know. She lost three children. Her sister committed suicide. The man she was married to, Percy, his ex. Was pregnant with his child and walked into a river and killed herself. All of this was happening while she was writing it and rewriting it. And then eventually Percy, her husband, died, drowned at sea. So she was 25 years old before she'd finished what is the version that we all now know. And so all of that is kind of in there. And she actually says something in, about the production or about the
book.
And
then, of course, by today's standards, 25 is pretty young to have written
Extraordinary.
Frankenstein.
Right.
The enduring for centuries novel.
Right. Right. And she was exquisite. Mind. But she also was raised and born of exquisite minds. Like, her father was a writer and an activist, and her mother was a writer and an activist. And her mother died 11 days after she was born. And so she only really got to know her mother through the works that her mother had written. And at the time, not much of her mother's work was published because she was a female, and females weren't allowed to publish or were not accepted. Their publications would not have been as well accepted as men. So when
the
she
19th
actually,
century is rough, man.
It really was. And in 1818, when she put her first version of Frankenstein out, she did so anonymously. And it was well received, but no one knew that she was the author.
But how do you honor something, some backstory like that, that is not in the text in this production?
So part of that is the mystery that slowly unravels about who this musician and who this storyteller are to each other. And so they have this history of telling these stories. And right when you walk into the well, let me just put it this way. Mary called Frankenstein a ghost story, even though there are no ghosts in it. The idea is that I'm going to tell you something that will stop you in your tracks, and you will hear, and it will scare you into hearing something that you may not have heard otherwise. In developing this play, Dana Omar, the musician, who is also our music director and composer, and Joni Schultz, our director, the three of us sort of discovered a ghost story of our own. And that's what's existing on stage between the musician and the storyteller. And you almost know that right when you walk into the theater. So even before the show starts, you see us on stage, and one of us is working, and one of us is watching the other working, setting the stage up. And one of us can see the other, and the other can't. And so you begin. And we've changed the title because of this. So it's no longer just Frankenstein. We call it Frankenstein, a ghost story. So that we're basically trying to find. This is our way of sort of getting into or unveiling what Mary's pain and joy and confusion of being alive, all of the things that she talked about and wrote about in this book and outside of this book, we found a way to sort of express that through this relationship as it's being unfolded to the audience, as they're telling this story. So in a way, the act of storytelling is a thing that is beginning to save or bring well, I don't know if save is the right word, but eventually, yeah, I think the impact of storytelling changes our storyteller in front of us. And hopefully because of that change, we are changed by it as well. But not just him, she is changed along the way too. And it's so hard to talk around like yeah. what some of this is, because some of it's a bit of a surprise. But
so without surprising something that you want to save, can you pick a moment where you feel you've made a meaningful decision about how to approach the story that is in the book Frankenstein and also the story of the writing of Frankenstein?
Yeah.
Spoiling one moment doesn't spoil the whole play, Kyle.
You're right. It doesn't. You're right. And I'm still learning how to talk about it, right? So like, it feels like maybe I'll tell you this. I'll just tell you. When Mary lost Percy, it was an extraordinary event in her life. Also losing children, the same thing. Like, it's indescribable. And that creature, in a way, kind of stands for that indescription. Mary even called him once the nameless mode of naming the unnameable, because the creature was not given a name and had no identity, and there was nothing else like him in the world. So in a way, his very presence is sort of this thing that can't be explained, even from his own understanding. And I think that's, in a lot of ways, that's what grief looks like. So I really centered on what Mary must have gone through when she lost Percy, because they made these kids together, that the two of them lost together. So they shared a grief. But when he was gone, she had no one to share that grief with anymore. And that found its way into who this musician and storyteller are to each other, and how they are supposed to continue telling their own stories without both of them, without each other. And so we begin to talk about grief before we even know that we're talking about grief on stage. I think the way that we watch someone long for someone who is no longer there, and the way that we imagine how someone might long for someone when they themselves are no longer on this planet, or no longer alive. There's that
word. The way a ghost might long for
the way a ghost might long for something. And the way memory works is the same as the way a ghost might work, right? Like the memory lives in us sometimes as a thing that we can't stop thinking about because we're working through something or we're trying to figure something out or we can't let it go because it stings us because we can't understand how to move forward with it or we can't understand how something happened. And that's how grief and memory sort of work. But the ghost logic sort of works the same. That's a term we use in rehearsal that explains the unfinished business. You know, they're there for a reason. And there is this old saying, right, that if you love them, let them go. And that I think that works in grief, right? That you can't. I've seen those ghost stories as old as time about how a ghost will haunt that person until that person learns to move on, and then the ghost is free, and then he is free, or she is free, or whatever. And the way that we must move through that grief is something that is profoundly difficult, and still don't know how to talk about. And I think that's what we're having so much fun with in this. Well, fun is the wrong word.
yes, and this sounds like a real party.
Right, exactly. And Mary has this quote that she says that she talks when she talks about this book of hers that we all know, well, hopefully. But she says, "Its several pages speak of many a walk, many a drive, and many a conversation when I was not alone, and my companion was one who in this world I shall never see more." And so that's how she remembers her book. She doesn't remember it as someone writing this story based on a competition among friends once upon a time when they said, let's see who could write the best ghost story. And she came up with the best one, much younger than the rest of her friends. And
she sees it as a walk with people who are no longer with her.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Like that. Yes, she cannot think about the pages or any of its scenes, or any of its words, or their characters' needs without thinking about her own needs, or the needs of people who are no longer there, or the needs they shared together.
You know, it's interesting because when you talk about that that Frankenstein, whether you're giving him that name or not, that the monster can represent whatever you're struggling with,
yes,
is really super interesting.
Yes, yes, I think that's it's fun that you said that too, because part of this adaptation, this guy as the storyteller, as he's telling the story, talks about how this adaptation was made as he's telling it, and so in a way, you're kind of hearing bits and pieces of like, oh, I see how this creature was made, so to speak. But at the same time, I think that. I used to get, you know, really hard-nosed about, like, you know, we should know the difference between Frankenstein and his creature, but really not knowing the difference is the point, right? To identify the Victor Frankenstein with his creature is exactly the Mary's idea, I think, that you cannot separate the two, that a person's actions is sort of their legacy. And the results of them is sort of their legacy, yeah.
Kyle Hatley, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kyle's Frankenstein, A Ghost Story at the Rep opens tonight and runs through April 5th. That's at the Copacan Stage. I'm Gina Kaufman. When we return, another version of an old play, but this one's not so much an homage as a takedown of Shakespeare. Stay with us. The Taming of the Shrew is a Shakespearean comedy that is both funny and deeply offensive. Just calling a woman a shrew is pretty bad for starters, and then there's the idea that you're going to tame her, and that's all just in the title. This play has been outrageously offensive for a long time. The first time I remember it being made fun of for that was when the TV show Moonlighting did a spoof in 1986. And yes, I realize that some of you were not even born yet, but this was a big cultural moment, so here is a dashing young Bruce Willis in a tunic, readying himself to meet his new bride.
Say that she shriek! Why, then I'll tell her plain she sings as sweetly as a nightingale. Say that she sneer. Why, then I'll say she looks as clear as morning roses newly washed with the dew. And failing that, always am I the man. And as the man, and a man's man at that, must I man the proper place of a man, over woman, that is. For I am what I am, and that's all that I am. And the man is the man is the man.
If you're a man, you gotta love the 16th century.
When they make fun of your gender assumptions on 1980s television, you know it's bad. Well, now, we get more than a spoof. A bunch of women in Kansas City's theater scene are staging a Taming of the Shrew takedown. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Natalie Liccardello. Hi, Natalie.
Hello.
So tell me, first of all, about the Taming of the Shrew, the original Shakespearean play.
That's lofty there. Okay. So basically, everybody knows the general, I would assume most people know the general.
But not everyone. Let's not assume.
I will not assume. I know what that does. Okay. So basically, plot points would be there's a man in Padua who has two daughters. One is very lovely and everybody wants to marry her. The other is very headstrong and shrewish, as you would assume. And he's made a rule that the young, pleasant daughter is not allowed to get married until her older sister does, which, you know, that's great for, you know, family relationships.
Really good. Yeah,
exactly. So as luck would have it, this man comes to town whose only goal is to marry a rich woman and doesn't seem to, you know, matter to him if she's shrewish or not. And that actually sort of does something for him, I think. So when he meets Catherine, Petruchio is his name, he says, this is great. We're gonna get married. I have your father's consent, which is the only consent that matters. And, will you, nil you, I will marry you. And so through a couple scenes of gaslighting, general abuse and other terrible things, he wins her over somehow and beats her into submission.
And this is a comedy.
It's a comedy. Uh-huh. And so there's other fun Shakespearean mistaken identity and what, like, all this role playing and whatnot going on in the other relationship in the show. But sort of central to the most offensive themes are this Petruchio Catherine dynamic. And by the
end, the whole, like, marrying against your will.
Why would you? Yeah, exactly. Your father's consent. That's all that we need.
So then, what you knew when you were approached about writing an adaptation was that it was supposed to be for an all-female cast. Everything else was basically up for grabs, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And this is a reversal of the old Shakespearean model where men played all the characters originally.
Exactly. Yes, yes. So when Rising Tide came to me and asked me to approach this project in sort of a new way, I sat with it for a little while. I wrote a version of it. We workshopped it with our cast. And then I took that version and I put it in the trash.
What did you hate so much about it?
It wasn't working. There was something about it that just wasn't, it didn't have what we needed to adequately flip this story on its ear. So one night, Shauna Jernigan and I, who directed the piece, went out for a couple drinks and we're just sort of spitballing different ideas. And we landed on this idea and just ran with it. And it sort of took off from there.
So the idea is kind of that this is a support group for people who have committed crimes against Shakespeare.
Yes.
What is a crime against Shakespeare?
Everybody's seen Richard III is a Nazi. We don't need to see that again. We've all seen what people think are inventive versions of Shakespearean shows. We make fun of them in the show, like Titus on Mars, Much Ado, the punk rock musical, that sort of thing. Everybody wants to put their own spin on Shakespeare, and some are more successful than others.
But part of the exercise, as I understand it, for the therapy that these people are going through is that, you know, a very legit therapeutic idea is returning to the scene of the crime.
Yes, yes. So they're being asked by their group leader when the premise is they come to this therapy session. They don't know what show they're going to be working through. And very early on, they realize that there's no men in the group that night, which is strange for them. And then they're assigned Taming of the Shrew as their exercise. And they're very adverse to that.
They don't want to go back to this one.
They do not. No.
Because it hurts too much?
It hurts too much. It's just, there's not a lot of good for women in that show. There are productions that have tried to give the women in the show more agency, but it really is a stretch. You really do have to try really hard to
read that. You kind of have to make it not that show.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what, I know you can't tell us what happens, but I guess, just pivoting a little bit, I think for a lot of people, Shakespeare is this figure who is held in such high esteem, and for a lot of good reasons, but that they don't really give themselves permission to criticize Shakespeare, let alone have fun taking poetic license on this level.
Right. Or they write it off as something that they don't understand. But so many of our modern tropes were born in Shakespeare's work. And if people give it a chance or see a production that really speaks to them, it's not so difficult to understand. It is more accessible than people think that it is.
So then this is an exercise in also not just taking down Taming of the Shrew, but making the author of Taming of the Shrew accessible, which is pretty interesting. Like, no, this is approachable when you think about it through a genuinely contemporary lens. Like, when you think about it as yourself, really paying attention to what this story is.
I agree. Part of what we wrote into this production is after every scene of Shakespeare's, the women, the characters, they break down the scene for themselves, not so much for the audience, but it is a device for the audience to sort of catch up if they missed some things in the Shakespearean language.
So when you think about the press release for this show and the promotional materials, they were, I hope you don't mind my saying so, they were full on rants. And I was expecting, I guess, more of a rant in this studio.
I can rant all day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here for it.
I mean, it's just maddening to me. You know, we're living in a very special time where, you know, the Me Too movement. We talk a lot about in this piece. There's plenty to rant about. There really is. Part of what irked me the most was when I was doing research for this piece and was reading about some of the more recent productions. There's been a couple actual all-female versions of it just done straight overseas. And the female director of one particular production said that, you know, what we believe is that Catherine, right off the bat, the first day she meets Petruchio, falls in love with him. And so she's game for everything that happens after that. And you can direct that to a point, but he's still comparing her to like breaking in a falcon. Like, it's horrible. It's there's no world in which anybody could read this play as it is and get any kind of female agency out of it on the back end. And yes, he was writing as a man of his time. And there are some people that do believe he was writing it a little bit tongue in cheek. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that. I don't subscribe to that. And it is, there's a reason that you don't see it done often anymore. It's offensive. In my senior year at Stevens, I did Kiss Me, Kate, which is basically, you know, they're doing Taming of the Shrew inside of a warped other version of Taming of the Shrew. And for some reason, I wasn't horribly offended at 22 or whatever I was when I did that. But you know, we conclude the play with Catherine telling a group of women, "I am ashamed that women are so simple to offer war where they should kneel for peace or seek for rule, supremacy, and sway when they are bound to serve, love, and obey." Ta-da, go home.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do understand you wrote an extra scene.
I did. So what, going along with that premise that, okay, so Catherine's into it, we need to hear her say it. If I don't hear her say it, I don't believe it. I'm not going to buy into that. The suspension of disbelief is too hard for me. So we decided to write the scene between Catherine and Petruchio where it's they're going to play a joke on her father basically throughout until the end so they can get, you know, all of the lands that they were promised, all of the homes they were promised. And then Bianca gets to get married as well.
That's the younger sister.
Exactly.
So this is all a plot that she's in on if you write this scene, but it can't be unless you do.
Exactly.
But writing the scene still makes it that other story that you don't believe.
As long as we have her consent, then the horrible, like the abusive scenes sort of at the end where he doesn't let her eat, doesn't let her sleep, tells her that it's nighttime when it's clearly daytime. All of that becomes an exercise in how can we further, we as a couple, as Petruchio and Catherine, how can we further our goals before the show is over?
Do you feel like this whole exercise has gotten something off of your chest?
Yes.
Just like personally?
Yes. There's plenty of good work in Shakespeare's canon. There's plenty of good work in coming out of that time in theatrical history. Let's be careful in what we choose to do and how what the stories we choose to tell and how we choose to tell them, with an eye on today. You know, we don't have to snowflake everything. We don't have to cancel Shakespeare because of shows that he wrote that we may not agree totally with. We can still do them, but let's do them intelligently.
Well, Natalie Licardello, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
The Taming of the Shrew, an all-female twist on the Bard's controversial tale, is already being performed at the Living Room. You can still catch shows through this weekend, so you gotta hurry up on this one. Once again, it's at the Living Room. It's a creation of Rising Tides Productions. That's a wrap for the day and the week. Go to kcur.org/centralstandard for anything you missed on today's arts show. Plus, if you go back to Monday's show, we played a diary of a Kansas Cityan living in China, his personal account of life under semi-quarantine throughout the coronavirus ordeal so far. It's really funny and poignant and informative, actually. So check it out, kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. We love to hear what's on our listeners' minds, and we love to chat you up. So hang out with us there at KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next, so stick around.